Good morning, Your Honor. Margaret England with Eckert, Seaman, Sharon, and Malott. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Dorothy Davis, who will be arguing for the appellee today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Ridgely, Justice Jacobs, may it please the court, my name is Douglas Shackman, and I represent the appellant in this court, the intervener below. We believe that this case brings to the court a very important issue of what Delaware's position will be when a party should not have standing, when a party does not have a legal interest in a lawsuit. This may be a case of first impression for this court, but it's certainly not for many others. And we've cited cases to this court that arise out of Ohio, Massachusetts, Louisiana, Florida, and Texas.
As I understand your brief, Mr. Shackman, you just told us that this is the issue in the case, yet your brief suggests that the trial judge did not address the issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why didn't the trial judge, do you know?
He gave two reasons. One is that he asserted that only the real party in interest could raise that issue. Specifically, I think I quoted a dialogue in which the judge says, well, if the real party doesn't raise it, and the plaintiff doesn't raise it, then it doesn't matter if a third party raises it, which we believe completely undermines the purpose of Rule 17.
And your client's the third party intervenor?
That's correct, Your Honor. The second reason he gave, the legal justification was estoppel, and we believe that there is no merit whatsoever to the estoppel argument.
Well, I think that it would be helpful to us to try to boil down what precisely happened here. And so I have a couple of questions along those lines that I wanted to ask you. First of all, your client did not get into the picture until 2003, correct?
2004, Your Honor. Well, it depends what you mean by picture. If you mean the lawsuit, it was 2004.
No, I mean your client did not obtain any interest in the property.
That's correct.
But and then the record shows that in November of 2003, your client purchased a second mortgage. That is the mortgage that the owners at that time, the Johnsons, gave to another company called Master Financial. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and then a few weeks later, same year, in December of 2003, your client actually took title from the Johnsons to a quitclaim through a quitclaim deed.
That's also correct.
So your client stands in the position of being a second mortgage holder and the equity owner. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. At the time, it is correct, is it not, that at the time your client obtained these interests in the property, there was already on record a first mortgage that was in the name of U.S. Bank. Is that correct?
Not exactly. There was a mortgage in the name of Equicredit.
I'm sorry, correct. That is correct. Equicredit of Delaware. That was on record.
That's correct.
So your client knew that there was a prior lien.
Unfortunately, that's not correct.
Well, your client was charged with knowledge.
He's charged.
Had legal knowledge, whether he had actual knowledge or not.
Yeah, the title searcher missed.
Okay, so what we're dealing with then is the interest of your client, both as owner, equity owner of the property, and also as second lien holder. That interest in avoiding a foreclosure sale by the first lien holder, which would either wipe out your client's second lien and or wipe out the equity. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And is it also correct that the legal basis for your client's interventions, whether it have been by objection or by actual motion to intervene, was that the judgment that was obtained on August 29th of 2002 that gave rise to the foreclosure was not a judgment that was entered in the name of U.S. Bank, and yet U.S. Bank had no interest of record.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's part of it.
Well, I thought that was most of it at the time. That is, let me just make sure that we understand. It was on August 29th, 02, that U.S. Bank got a judgment entered against the Johnsons, who were your predecessors in title. Correct,
Your Honor.
But they got judgment on a mortgage foreclosure, and the mortgage was not in the name of U.S. Bank. It was in the name of Equicredit of Delaware.
Correct.
It appears that there was an assignment from Equicredit of Delaware to U.S. Bank, but that assignment didn't take place until a month or so after the judgment was entered. That is, there was no assignment giving U.S. Bank any interest on which it could then proceed to foreclosure until after the judgment had been entered.
That's correct, and we assert the assignment was invalid. But the timing that you state is correct.
Okay, whether it was valid or not, it wasn't. There was no assignment at the time the judgment was entered. Correct. And as I understand it, one of your positions was that for that reason, when the judgment, which is the legal basis for the foreclosure, was entered, it was invalid. That is, it was not entered on behalf of any party that had a cognizable legal interest in obtaining the judgment. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
All right. Was there some other legal basis besides what I've just set forth?
No, there are subparts to that, but you've stated our legal basis.
Okay.
For the initial opposition. Later on.
And the conclusion that you drew is, number one, that the court, couldn't, any foreclosure, that basic problem was never cured, and therefore the foreclosure was invalid and should be undone.
Correct.
Okay, and the reason it should be undone is either because the court didn't have jurisdiction to hear the case, that is, to proceed with the case, that's one of your arguments, or even if it did have jurisdiction, it had no legal basis to exercise jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
When your client's first involvement was November 29, 2004, according
to the lawsuit.
Charge, yep. In the lawsuit. And I, from reading the Superior Court judge's comment, after 7 years and a promise by prior counsel to the court that you would get to the bottom of it and have it, how much more time do you need to get to the bottom of this? There was apparent frustration with this stretching out for so long. And even if we accept your position that estoppel is the wrong reason, when can a Superior Court judge essentially dismiss your motion for failure to prosecute it when it's been dragging along for so long, even if all of your points are legally correct?
Your Honor, I would answer that in two ways. One is it depends on the underlying issue involved. And what I mean by that, for instance, if there was something void, let's say the defendant never jurisdiction over him in Delaware, and therefore the court might deem the judgment void. We believe there is no time, that a void judgment is always invalid, and that from there on there's a continuum relating to the importance of the interest to the court. And here we believe that it goes to the integrity of the process, that as these federal courts have held, that a plaintiff in the Northern District of Ohio, when they dismissed 14 cases, said it was a constitutional issue, that there has to be minimal standing in order to bring suit.
Well, was it argued to the Superior Court judge that this judgment is void and should be vacated?
I'm not sure if the word void was used. We certainly said that it was invalid because there was never a plaintiff who had a legal interest.
That is, the mortgage was valid, but
the judgment. We're talking about the judgment.
But
was
the
invalid.
Party that got the judgment enforcing it had no legal interest in that mortgage and therefore no basis to proceed as the plaintiff. That is, it was being enforced. The mortgage default, or the default mortgage, was being enforced by the wrong party.
That's correct. We never got to the part about actually looking at the mortgage itself. We weren't allowed to do discovery.
Well, your client took a quit claim interest in the property, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why should we care what happens after that? Isn't that a risk-taking event? And isn't it correct your client paid nothing on the mortgage that he complains about today?
He paid nothing on the mortgage. He took out his own mortgage loan for, I believe, $225,000. So he's contributed mightily to the property.
What does the very essence of a quit claim deed say to a buyer?
Well, of course, you're taking what interest that the plaintiff has, and that the seller has. And as far as we know, the seller had, you know, complete interest in the property. There wasn't a disputed title in the matter. But to answer your question, we believe the interest is the integrity of the process.
Well, the interest your client has, I mean, your client bought second position behind Equicredit of Delaware. Is that correct?
It thought it was buying first position because of the
whether it thought it was, it didn't. It actually has second position. But even so, as a second lien holder, it has an interest in not having its lien wiped out.
Correct, Your Honor.
And as the holder of the residual equity by virtue of the quitclaim deed, I suppose you would argue that your client has a similar interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
So to that extent there, your client would have standing to insist that if there is going to be a foreclosure that wipes out the equity and or the second mortgage, that it be done in the proper way.
Yes, Ryan. Standing, we understand, not
that. That's what you're talking about when you talk about the integrity of the process, right?
Well, as to this matter, we believe it relates to the fact that plaintiffs should not be able to come into court and say that they hold an interest in a lawsuit or an interest in a instrument when they have no such interest.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes, Ron. Justice Ridgely, I never completed my answer to you. I answered the first part as to the law. The second part is, and I've tried to identify it through the timeline, that the Superior Court was simply wrong that Mr. Gunn had not actively pursued things. He filed his motion in November of 2004. The plaintiff then voluntarily stayed the sheriff's sale and did nothing more for 2 years. Instead, it filed a second foreclosure action, this time naming Mr. Gunn as a defendant. And Mr. Gunn actively defended that lawsuit. It felt like that's where the battle was. Then, after 2 years, the plaintiff changed legal counsel, retained Ms. Charlton. It filed a second pleuris at that time. And Mr. Gunn again actively defended it. And as the hearing transcript before Judge Herlihy reflects, Ms. Charlton made no objection whatsoever to a stay because the prior counsel for plaintiff wouldn't communicate with counsel for Mr. Gunn. There was a delay then. Then Ms. Charlton filed another LEFAC. I believe that was the third LEFAC, third pleuris. And the same day that the court denied the motion, Ms. Charlton presented Mr. Gunn with an agreement, which would have wiped out all of the dispute. He would have bought whatever interest the plaintiff had in the proceedings.
Mr. Shackman, I'm not sure where you're going with all this. I mean, what's the bottom line?
I was responding to Justice Ridgely.
I understand that, but you've lost me anyway.
I apologize. That Superior Court's comments that Mr. Gunn didn't actively pursue his claim.
So that goes to estoppel, is that right?
That's
that
correct.
He delayed unreasonably. You're saying he didn't delay unreasonably. Well, at every opportunity when it became necessary, he objected to the foreclosure and he got relief. That is, for whatever reason, the foreclosure stopped.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And I thought your position was that it was he wasn't under any obligation to do anything more until he became a formal party to the proceedings as a result of the intervention, which was this year.
That's right. He did not have the right to do discovery.
All right. Now, at that point, arguably, he might have been under some duty to complete discovery, but was there an order entered directing Mr. Gunn to do that?
Your Honor, the same procedure.
That's a yes or no.
It's difficult to answer because the same procedure.
Well, either there was an order directing him to complete discovery or not.
He was denied discovery. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The same proceeding that he was granted intervention orally from the bench is the proceeding in which the court denied discovery and...
Okay, so the answer is no, he wasn't under any order.
He had no right to do discovery. That's correct, Your Honor.
But he had asked to intervene before, and that was denied by Judge Hurley?
That's correct.
And what was the date of that?
That was July of 2007. I can't recall the day of the month, but that was July of 2007, just before there was this agreement that he would buy out the plaintiff's interests.
And that's an interlocutory order?
We believe so, yes, Your Honor.
I recognize that your argument presumes that the assignment is invalid, but in addressing your core argument, it looks to me like the trial judge said, assuming that the assignment is valid, what difference does it make that the assignment was made after the original filing? And in that respect, he brushed aside your argument that the real party in interest didn't file the action.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that may be a cursory way of addressing the real party in interest question, but he seemed to believe that it made no meaningful difference that the assignment came after the action that was filed was in fact a ratification. Is that incorrect?
He never used the term ratification, and I think I look at it more as whether it was moot. But he never said it was a ratification, I believe.
I think you're correct. The transcript doesn't reflect that he uses that term, but isn't that a fair way of characterizing his thought?
It may be. I don't believe you can ratify an unlawful act.
Mr. Shagman, you did cite cases from Ohio and other jurisdictions. My question is, what exactly is their pertinence? Is it to show that these same financial institutions have been involved in this sort of loose practice that you're complaining about here in other jurisdictions and the courts there granted relief?
Your Honor, there were two types of cases that I cited. One specifically was the Federal Trade Commission class action against SPS, who appears to have been driving this lawsuit. That's yes to that part of it. Then we cited many federal court cases that stand for the principle we're asserting, and that is you have to have a real party in interest to begin the law.
So what happened here happened also in other jurisdictions, and the court reacted adversely to that. Is that right?
That's correct. And what they regard as kind of a rampant way, dismissing 27 lawsuits, dismissing 14 lawsuits. But thank you. I see my time is expiring.
I have one more question,
yes, sir.
Even if your time expires. On page 28 of your brief, you say, this court has great inherent power to take appropriate sanctions against a party which makes misleading statements to a court. And then you cite two cases from the Court of Chancery. By this court, which court did you mean? Superior Court, Supreme Court, or the Court of Chancery?
All of them, Your Honor. Any court has the right to sanction a party which makes misleading statements to the court.
And the misleading statement was what?
That USB, United States Bank, was the plaintiff in the action, when later on it was to say that it wasn't participating.
Right, the same U.S. Bank that got an assignment after they filed the action.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, particularly Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely, it is truly an honor and a privilege to be before you today. If I might directly address an issue that was raised in prior questioning, and that is exactly what was the interest of U.S. Bank National Association at the time of the filing of the complaint in foreclosure, at the time of the default judgment, and that at the time of the ultimate sale. As the justices can see from the complaint, both by the caption and by the first paragraph, we do demonstrate that, in fact, this mortgage was part of a securitization. And U.S. National Bank Association is the trustee. It is the entity that was the assignee of the original mortgagee, Equicredit Corporation of Delaware. And as you see in the first paragraph, we clearly identify that the trust, the securitization, was dated June of 1998. And even using the articles that we don't believe are appropriate, nonetheless, in the appellee's record, you will see that what we have here is a standard securitization that was properly effectuated.
Excuse me, counsel, but I'm looking now at page A56 of the record. That is page 56 of the appellant's appendix, which is the motion to stay sheriff's sale, Mr. Gunn's motion. And paragraph one of that motion reads, plaintiff, which is your client, secured a judgment against defendants as the assignee of Equicredit Corporation of Delaware on August 29, 2002. Is that a correct statement?
It is not, Your Honor.
It is not?
It is not, Your Honor.
It did not have an assignment.
No, what is incorrect is the capacity in which U.S. Bank took the judgment. It took it in its capacity as trustee of a securitization. And it is in that capacity that the default was entered. And that is important because under Delaware law, what one must have in order to prosecute a foreclosure is to have the real party in interest. Although Delaware has not addressed this issue particularly, we have demonstrated other jurisdictions that have. And using traditional trust law, it is the trustee that has the legal right, and it is only the trustee that may prosecute a foreclosure.
Why then was an assignment obtained a month later if that's the case? Why was it necessary to go through all that?
The securitization actually effectuated the assignment consistent with the UCC when the actual assignment occurred. So the interest attached immediately when the securitization was established. And then what?
Well, there's nothing in the record that shows when all of that happened, is there?
There is, Your Honor. It's in our complaint because that's the nature of a securitization. And under Delaware law, the actual notice of an assignment, not the assignment itself, did not have to be of record. In response to
that's your legal position.
Yes, Your Honor.
That is, there didn't need to be a form of assignment. I gathered there was some sort of a transfer of the mortgage paper to the bank in its capacity as trustee and into a pool, and then that pool ended up getting securitized. And if I understand it right, your position is that the in its capacity of trustee of the pooled assets, that is the mortgages, your client, U.S. Bank, had standing and sufficient interest to foreclose on the mortgage. Is that right? When it became defaulted.
With all due respect, there's a lot in there. Absolutely, when it was securitized, the interest vested. The distinction I draw is that the actual notice of the assignment that vested in 1998 under Delaware law did not have to be recorded.
Okay.
At all.
But whether it had to be recorded or not, your position is that once the pool was created and the mortgage paper was transferred to the pool, that created a cognizable interest in your client.
That is correct.
That gave it standing to bring the foreclosure action.
That is correct, Mr.
Now, that's a contested proposition of law, isn't it? That is, that's something that is at least as litigatable. It's not established either as the law of this case or any other case that was cited to us. Is that right?
With all due respect, I do believe that I disagree because under traditional trust law, although not adjudicated in Delaware, we do cite to cases that demonstrate that it is that the only party who has the legally cognizable ability to act once that trust has been set up.
Yeah, but whether traditional trust law governs this type of commercial arrangement is a question that is litigatable, is it not? And isn't it the case that that question was never litigated in this case? I mean, that goes to the merits of whether or not Mr. Shackman's client had a valid objection. And the Superior Court basically never addressed that question at all.
I believe that the issue was litigated in the sense that it was asserted and it was not disputed until such time as that it became too late to raise it.
What do you mean too late to raise it?
Because after 7 years and after, I think most critically, the estoppel is based upon two very important...
Well, wait. Mr. Gunn raised the issue of standing from the very first time he started objecting to the foreclosure.
Well, he raises it very specifically in 2007. He raises it in 2004 and 2007, and that's what he was given leave to discover, and he never did. And specifically in 2007, a motion to vacate the default and to intervene
denied. It was in 2002 that your client got the judgment and foreclosed in that year, and from 2002 through 2009, there were a series of attempts to foreclose, that is to have a foreclosure sale. And on each of these occasions, is it not true, Mr. Shackman's client took the position that your client never had a valid judgment because it never had a valid interest in the mortgage that was being foreclosed on.
I believe that he specifically raises on two occasions, not on every occasion, Your Honor, Mr. Justice.
Well, he may have argued that your client had no cognizable interest for perhaps the wrong reason. But it was your client that was taking the position that it always had, that at least from 1998 on, it had a sufficient interest to be the plaintiff in a foreclosure action.
Yes, we believe, following Delaware law specifically, that is what the law permitted us to do, and that is what we alleged.
But that issue never got resolved in the lower court.
I believe that it did get resolved as it vis-a-vis our borrowers, because we were able to take a default, and I do believe that it was resolved vis-a-vis Mr. Gunn in 2007 when counsel brought a motion to vacate the default. We're inherent in that.
Is there a ruling anywhere in the record by the by Judge Silverman or any other Superior Court judge holding that the securitization, the process by which U.S. Bank became the trustee in 1998, gave it a sufficient legal interest to obtain the judgment that was obtained in 2002?
It is our position that Judge Silverman's denial of the motion to vacate comprehended the concept, but using the words eloquently stated by Mr. Justice, no.
The first denial of the motion to vacate, was that an interlocutory order, or could that have been appealed?
It is our position, although not set forth in our brief and without authority, that that was a final determination and not interlocutory.
Now, do you agree that if a real party of interest is not involved in securing a judgment, that the judgment is void?
I'm sorry, may I ask you to repeat that question?
Let's assume an action is brought by someone who is not a real party in interest, and they achieve a default judgment. Is that judgment void? And can that judgment be attacked at any time?
I believe that the judgment is voidable. I do not believe that it can be attacked at any time. It would depend upon a multitude of circumstances, Mr. Justice.
All right. So, such as?
the proper party to have standing to raise the voidability must be the party that would be one circumstance in which if that party doesn't have proper standing, they could not raise the issue. I believe that
if someone's about to have their property sold, they have standing, don't they?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. It depends upon what one means by having a title to the property and whether or not one was a BFP of the property, whether one had obtained approval of a bankruptcy court who had that property as an asset to purchase the property. So there are a lot of circumstances that could materially affect the questions that you're asking.
All right. Well, in this case, the circumstances of this case, are you saying that Mr. Shackman's client lacks standing to bring any challenge?
I believe in the circumstances of this case, he lacks standing to collaterally attack the default judgment not entered against him. Yes, I do take that position, Mr. President.
Why? That is, what's the basis for your contention that Mr. Gunn lacks standing? He is, after all, or was, the holder of the second lien position and also the holder of the residual equity.
He's the holder of the second lien position without consideration. He alleges that he, through quitclaim deed, is in possession of the property, yet at the time the property was in the bankruptcy estate of the original borrowers.
Okay, so your argument is that he never obtained those interests in a valid way?
That's correct, Mr. Judge.
Was that position ever presented to and adjudicated by the Superior Court?
It was not.
As I read the trial judge's ruling distilled to its minimum point, the issues that are being discussed with you were never discussed with him because he concluded rather quickly, without written opinion, that whether or not the assignment was valid wasn't really an issue, and who was the real party in interest, even if the assignment was invalid, was moot because the plaintiff was stopped from going forward, given the period of time of 7 years or so that he had to raise the issues he raised, and he hadn't raised them until that point. Is it any more complicated than that, as the trial judge saw it?
Yes, Mr. Justice, and I believe that the trial judge explained that it was more complex and that he had been the trial judge at least three other hearings, there had been one other hearing, and that, in fact, he was well familiar with the record in which the assignment issues and the standing and the fact that Delaware law does not require the record notice of an assignment at the time of a default or at the time of a foreclosure. And I think that is the distinction. It was raised that Delaware law only provides that one must only be a trustee and must have an interest. Delaware law does not provide that one must have an assignment which provides record notice of that interest. And Judge Silverman was well aware of the fact that these issues had been raised through hearings, had been raised in 2004, had been raised in 2007 through three different attorneys, the last attorney promising the court that they would in fact undertake the discovery that would have been necessary to demonstrate what I'm telling you today. And I am at a disadvantage because I'm arguing from a record that was never developed, but had the record been developed, Mr. Justice, as you would have found that, in fact, a proper purchase agreement had been effectuated, proper assignments had vested as early as the securitization, which was in 1999, that Equicredit of Delaware had, in fact, assigned its interest to U.S. Bank as trustee.
Are they one of the same, Equicredit of Delaware and Equicredit of America?
They are not, Mr. Justice. Equicredit of Delaware is an entity separate and apart, separate from Equicredit of the United States. And there, and one could take notice that the fact that there was a merger of Equicredit of Delaware as well as all the other Equicredits across the country into Nations Credit Financial. Nations Credit Financial then is a wholly owned subsidiary of Equicredit of America, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Bank of America. However, in each state, each of the operating Equicredit entities was not wound up and continues to exist for purposes of administration of these many loans that are now, you know, out and being, are still being paid in large part. 97% of our mortgages are still performing. It's the 7% that are not.
Counsel, the record before us shows that Equicredit of Delaware formally assigned to U.S. Bank its interest in the mortgage that's at issue here on September 30th of 2002, which was a month after U.S. Bank obtained the judgment. You don't dispute that, do you?
I dispute its interpretation.
Well, you don't dispute the fact, do you? That is when the assignment was executed, and the record also shows that that executed assignment was not recorded until 2 years later, that is December 8th of 2004.
The record notice of the assignment, in distinction to the vesting of the assignment itself, I do make it an important distinction, and at the time...
I'm sorry, I'm just asking you whether you disagree with those facts. I mean, that's what the record shows. I may be misinterpreting it, but that's I can give you the record cites if you want to check that.
I could probably cite it to you, Your Honor. I will, with all due respect, I agree with you, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I
agree with you, Your Honor.
Okay, I mean, you don't disagree with the facts. You disagree with whatever inferences should be drawn from those facts. Is that right?
I hesitate to say that the written document itself is a fact. I acknowledge that the record notice existed, and it's in the record, and the document speaks for itself. But with all due respect, if Your Honor characterizes that a fact, then I'm going to agree with your with Mr. Justice that that is a fact. One point that is not yet been raised, and I believe is very important, that discovery would have elicited had discovery been brought either in 2004 when Attorney Abbott said it was going to happen, and I commend to the court the wherefore clause in that motion, as well as in 2007, is there would have been shown a servicing agreement, which RESPA clearly provides, that says that the servicing of this mortgage through the trustee is done through a servicing company, which was Fairbanks Capital Corporation, who changed its name to Select Portfolio Servicing, which is not a party to this case and could not have been a party.
When could the discovery have commenced? You're saying it could have commenced in 2004. I thought a motion to intervene was denied.
Well, no, actually what happens is in 2004, the parties agree as a result of that motion that they will take 4 months. There's a stay, and during that time, you will see from the record that Attorney Carlton says, you can either file your title claim, you can try to refinance, we can work through these issues. It was at that point that, and if you go to the wherefore clause of that motion, it specifically says that one, what we're going to accomplish during this time period is to, in essence, look at the efficacy of the lien holder. So that's the first time when truly the basis for Judge Silverman's estoppel attaches, is in 2004. Then it attaches again in 2007, when they still continue to raise the efficacy of the original lien.
Counsel, just one pointed question. What exactly is the legal source of the obligation that your side contends Mr. Gunn had to get done with the discovery?
Because he was not a non-party.
What was the legal source? Was it an order of the court? What was the compulsion?
I would say it was directives by the court that the issues were to be addressed.
And is there a record cite for that directive?
I would cite, Your Honors, to our record B33A81, which is the Gunn motion to stay and vacate in 207. And then I would refer, Your Honors, to the transcript of the hearing in front of Judge Jerome
Hurley,
wherein the transcript provides, but the court does not enter an order. The court does enter an order. The court enters an order staying the proceeding for 4 months in which all of these activities are to occur. So I would commend to your justices those portions of the record.
That, and that the cite for that is what?
Is it in your appendix? Do you recall?
I believe it is in the appellate's appendix, but if I may request leave to provide that citation, B18, and that proceeds through B33.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate it very much. My final point would be had...
I'm sorry, but your time is up.
Oh, thank
it you. May be that we forced you to search through the appendix and it used up your time, but it's up. Sorry.
I apologize. I should have known the citation. It was a pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Two quick points. One is this already been recognized in the denial of the motion to intervene. There is no legal right to take discovery. The other thing that is in the record, despite plaintiffs' statements that they would produce things, is in the record the affidavit of Mr. Gunn. They would never produce to him the note. And they would not ever, also in the record is the fact they would never voluntarily submit to a deposition when I requested it. And then, of course, Judge Silverman did not require that.
Do you dispute as a matter of law the point that you heard your colleague make about the bank standing as a trustee?
I do, Your Honor. And if you take a look at their complaint, I think what they're mixing together is two different principles. Paragraph 1 of their complaint says nothing about this instrument. What it describes is the history of who the plaintiff is and that there was a securitization created in 1998. It doesn't say anything about this particular instrument being assigned. And if we go back to the history of the parties...
Whether it says anything about an assignment or not, do you have any basis to dispute as a matter of law the bank was a trustee of this securitized pool and therefore had standing to bring the action it brought? Regardless of whether there was an assignment of any kind later, ever recorded or never recorded. Is there a genuine dispute of law on that issue?
There's a dispute of fact because it's not in the record. All they describe is who the entity is. There's nothing in the record that shows that this particular mortgage was part of that securitization.
Okay, if we were to disagree with you then on whether it is a fact of record, you agree that if it is a fact of record, that there is no legal argument about standing then that would flow from that fact?
We agree a trustee for assets held by the trust is the proper plaintiff, but not that jumps to the fact that this particular asset was part of the trust.
Okay. Thank you very much.
May I ask one question? The other side has indicated that regardless of whether or not intervention was granted, discovery was permitted. Do you disagree with that?
We do, Your Honor. And as we've stated, they wouldn't voluntarily agree to discovery. Their statements are not in the record. Ours are. Both the dialogue with Judge Silverman responded to by plaintiff's counsel that she would not submit U.S. Bank to a deposition, as well as Mr. Gunn's affidavit that he tried to get a note and U.S. Bank and SPS would never give him one.
Well, the logical thing to do if you have 4 months to take the necessary action to determine what the relationship between the parties are and one party won't agree to discovery, the natural thing to do is to come to the court and complain about that and compel discovery within the four-month period. File a motion to compel, correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Was that done?
Not as far as I know.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.